8. Not all that much life, it appeared. We were trounced in New York, 2-1. It was definitive, crushing, a paralytic wipeout. Picker thanked New York on behalf of Martha Harris and announced he was going home for a few days to rest and think about what's important, what's best for our country. We went home, too. Our campaign seemed over. Stanton didn't withdraw from the race immediately, but he returned to Mammoth Falls and the prosaic rituals of home state governance. There was no travel schedule. There were no staff meetings. People began to leave. I stayed. I called Daisy several times and left messages, but there was no answer. I ran along my old 3-mile route, down the river and back again. I read Middlemarch. I went each day to the headquarters and cleared files. A few stray muffins remained. A few older women, local volunteers, continued to answer the phones when they rang, which wasn't often. I didn't dare ask the governor or Susan about what came next. For 2 days after New York, I didn't speak to them at all. We just needed a break from each other, I guess. There was no real rush. The primary schedule thinned out at that point. It would be 3 weeks before the next big one, Pennsylvania, if we remained in business that long. I tried to think about what I was going to do with my life, but couldn't. I was staring off into space, not even pretending to be busy, when Libby walked into the office that Thursday. And that was the first thing I noticed. She walked. She didn't barge or boom. "Hey, kid," she said, scarily subdued, holding her Outback hat against her chest with both hands. "I got the tests. You're a part of this. You want to come up with me and tell the gov?" It was a perfect spring day. We walked up the hill to the Capitol, which was girded by a lush apron of coral, fuchsia, and white azaleas. Jack and Susan Stanton would preside over the Mammoth Azalea Festival that weekend. I remembered Donnie O'Brien's line about going back to ribbon cuttings and highway contracts. I'm sure Stanton did, too. There was a quietly efficient, back-to-normal air in the governor's office. Phones were ringing, which distinguished it from the mausoleum our campaign headquarters had become. Annie Marie ushered us in. Stanton sat behind his desk. I realized I had never seen him there before. In fact, it had been months since I'd been in that office. New Year's Eve, the day I met Daisy. She was the last person I'd seen there. She'd been smoking a cigarette, flipping through Leon's New Hampshire crosstabs. She pushed her glasses up on her forehead. She looked at me. "Well, Jack, you're in the clear," Libby said dully. This was all dreamlike and very strange. "You're not the father." He stared at his hands and exhaled. "Hell," Libby said, reviving a bit. "Uncle Charlie's not even the father." Stanton glanced at her sharply. "Does Willie know?" he asked. "Doc Wilkinson will call them," Libby said. "We should call them too," Stanton said. "He's going to be feeling awful, thinking he brought this thing down. Hell, we should all go over there for dinner tonight." He swiveled, stared out the window, down the hill toward the few scraggly, undistinguished modern skyscrapers downtown. "Henry," he said, turning back, "any press calls on this, there's no comment. And Sunday evening, we'll pull everyone together at the mansion, figure out where we take this thing from here, okay?" The meeting was over. Sort of. Libby wasn't getting up from her chair. Actually, she seemed to be trying to get up, but was unable to put the force of her will behind it. I'd never seen her indecisive before. "Libby," Stanton asked, "what on earth is the matter with you?" "Well, Libby." "Oh, shit," she sighed. "You know, I've been kind of interested in the Picker thing," she said softly, almost mumbling. "So I made some calls. One of them to Judy Lipinski, an old friend of mine. Used to be a scorp. Police reporter and a good one. A very tough chick. She's got an advertising sheet in Fort Lauderdale now. And she made some calls. And she, found this state senator who claims that Picker, well, that Picker gave him some money to vote for this project, a development south of Naples."
"When he was governor?" Stanton asked.
"Uh-huh," Libby said. The vote was state matching money for the county to build a connecting road, and also the approval of a federal water and sewer grant. And the thing is, the project, Tidewater Estates, was being developed by Sunshine Brothers, which is a subsidiary of Sunshine Savings and Loan, which is owned by Edgardo Reyes Cardinale. And Edgardo Reyes Cardinale is the brother of Antonia Reyes Cardinale, who is Baker's former wife, Stanton said and whistled. Geez, who else knows about this? What else do we know? Who's the senator? Will he talk? Libby just sat there. She didn't say anything. Libby, what the fuck is the matter with you? I've been trying to decide, she said, her voice trailing off. Decide what? Whether I want to do this for you, you stupid shit, she said, Libby once more. I bust dust. I protect you. I don't do oppo. Libby, what the fuck is the difference? All the difference in the world, she said. All the moral difference in the world. I'm not too interested in tearing Freddy Picker down. And if he's bent, Stanton said, if he's a crook? It'll out, she said. Yeah, but when, Stanton said. Say he wins the nomination, and then it comes out. If it's there, the Republicans will find it. That's for sure. They may already have it. Libby, we should at least know what they know. We should at least know what's there. Think of it as dust-busting for the Democratic Party, for all of us. Don't patronize me, Jack. We've known each other too fucking long. He cleaned your clock. But you'll do it, Stanton said. Oh, fuck you. I know you would. Henry, how would you like a nice Florida vacation? He asked. Nothing's happening around here till Sunday. And he was smiling now, playing with us. You guys worked so well together on the phony tapes. If the handshake is the threshold act of politics, what can one say of oppo? It is the primal impulse, the headwaters of all tactics and strategy, the oldest and most dishonorable exercise linked to the will to power. The Greeks did oppo. They learned it from the gods. Cassius did oppo. Even our sainted FDR used the Internal Revenue Service to scope out his opponents. It is a foundation of the trade, the darkest tool, the inevitable destination. It is where the story always ends. It can be done elegantly or not. Mostly not in the late 20th century. It can be done reluctantly or with relish. But it will always be done. And we would do it for Jack Stanton, Libby and I. We would do it as a ceremonial act, a genuflection to the origins of our craft, and as a release, our final service to the Stantons. We would do it almost ironically, standing at a distance from ourselves, curious about where we were going, how far we'd be willing to go. Without Libby, I wouldn't have gone. It was clear that her impulse was the same as mine, that she was propelled by the desire for symmetry, the need to tie up all the loose ends to see it through. We are in limbo now, Henri, in every sense of the word, she said as Jennifer Rogers drove us to the airport in Libby's red Jeep Cherokee. She was sitting up front, her hand massaging Jenny's neck. I sat in the back. We are outside the mainstream. We are in purgatory. We are lost. We are testing our limits. You remember the stupid song Limbo Rock? You remember the words? Hello, can you go? That's us, Henri. We are moral submariners. We've dived down into the shit, hoping for a shit bomb, hoping for a cure. Libby, let me ask you, I said. How did you know Jack wasn't the father of that child? He was the father of the mother's ignorance, Libby said, deep into cryptic limbo mode. In English, Libby, he gave in to the fundities on sex education, Libby said. He wouldn't fight that fight. So the girl didn't know her vagina from the mailbox. Her folks sure as hell didn't tell her much. I had to run a goddamn sex seminar for the poor kid. She actually thought the first guy who got to you after menstruation planted the seed. In this case, the happy farmer turned out to be the second guy who got to her that particular month. Jerome Dixon, who sat next to her in sixth period, social studies. Hoo-ha. Seventh period was a study hall. Jerome Dixon and Loretta McAllister studied biology in a broom closet 2 days after she ovulated. Jerome, I can assure you, will make an entirely incompetent father. And the first guy who got to her that month was Jack Stanton? I asked. We'll never know for sure, will we? Libby said. But your suspicion is as good as mine. The Gold Coast Time and Tides was a narrow storefront in a seedy strip mall on one of Fort Lauderdale's long, flat east-west boulevards. We arrived after hours, but it didn't appear to be the sort of place where much business was transacted at any time. There was a classified ad counter up front, then a single row of three desks. There were maps of Fort Lauderdale and the vicinity on the walls above the inevitable battered buff-colored file cabinets. Judy Lipinski sat at the rear desk, smoking a very long cigarette. She was wearing what appeared to be a Little Orphan Annie fright wig. It was, however, her own actual hyper-permed hair. Hey, Lips, Libby called out. Hey, Tongue, Judy replied in what appeared to be a ritual greeting. Henry Burton, deputy manager of the nearly defunct Jack Stanton for President campaign. Meet ya, said Judy Lipinski, standing now to shake hands. She was short, stacked, butchy, a feminine version of David Adler, it seemed, all shoulders and breasts and bravado. She was wearing a black and white polka dot sheath, white Minnie Mouse shoes, and lots of very red lipstick. How's Ralphie? Libby asked. Getting on, Judy replied. Ralph is Judy's husband, a former statey, Libby explained. She left me for him. She never told me if it was his gun or his badge. Or the fact that he ran the North Miami barracks and gave good copy, Judy said to me. Libby never did dig my ecumenicism. She didn't believe me when I told her my motto was different strokes for the same folks. She didn't believe me when I told her that penetration was violation, Libby replied. So, Lips, what have we got here? State Senator Orestes Rusty Figueroa, Judy said. He used to work out of Miami, but he retired and settled in up here. Dem or GOP? Cuban, Judy said. GOP, of course. That means old Jackie's right, Libby explained to me. Whatever this is, the Republicans probably already have it. That's also why it probably hasn't hit the papers yet. Well, there may be another reason, Judy said. Rusty isn't what might be called an unimpeachable witness. He had a for sale sign on his door and got caught eventually. His retirement included a suspended sentence. So why should we believe him? I asked. Because he was a crook, not necessarily a liar, Judy said. Anyway, Lib, your instructions were anything on Picker, right? Rusty Figueroa lived in a fine, sprawling ranch on one of the man-made islands in the inland waterway. He had silver hair and a mustache, but was still slim. No paunch distended his pale yellow guayavera. He welcomed us into his living room, which was elegant, subdued, a first-class hotel lobby, pleasant but undistinguished watercolors of tropical scenes sparsely rationed on stark white walls, Persian rugs, and a beige sectional couch, curving around a low, oval teak coffee table, facing a large flagstone fireplace. You ever use that thing? Judy asked. Occasionally, when I have to burn documents, Rusty said. He enjoyed being a rogue. A young woman servant brought a tray with iced tea, lemonade, Coke Perrier, and a lone bottle of Bacardi. I assume you wouldn't be interested in alcohol, he said. The world has become a much less interesting place over time. Even journalists and politicians who eat well and exercise, pity. But if any of you would like to join me in something stronger, rum and coca? No? Oh, well. We sat down on the couch, Libby and Figueroa facing each other, catty-cornered, Judy and I farther down. Libby was controlled, businesslike, very Sam Spade. She conducted the interrogation. So, Freddie Picker offered you a bribe to vote for this project? She asked. Not a bribe, Figueroa said. I never said bribe. I said contribution. How much? Libby asked. 1,000, he said. That was the going rate in those days.
The going rate?
Well, there were a lot of projects going up. A lot of roads and sewers being built. Progress, you might say, was my most important profit. He was enjoying this.
Do you have any record of it? Any way to prove it? Libby asked.
Well, he laughed. I didn't keep a little black book, but if you go back into my campaign committee records, you'll see contributions there from the Sunshine folks.
That's his brother-in-law's company, Libby said.
His brother-in-law's company. Figueroa laughed. And his wife's a director, and his brother Andy the executive vice president. So whose company is this really, right?
But who approached you? Was it Picker himself?
Oh, come on now.
And you claim to be active in national politics? Figueroa said.
The game has fallen on hard times.
Did you deal with Picker at all on this? Libby asked.
No, he said. Not on this. You'd see him around, though, down in Miami. He made the scene.
He made the scene?
Well, Tony's family was into everything good, if you know what I'm saying. And Freddie and Tony, you'd see them around in the mid-70s, together and apart, sometimes very much apart.
He chuckled appreciatively.
Who was the other man? I asked.
He looked at Judy, then Libby, then me.
Oh, you mean the guy Tony left him for? He said. Some Anglo attorney up there in Tallahassee.
And the governor? What was he like? How well did you know him? Libby asked.
He was okay. He was smart. He could do the job. Of course, he wasn't the saint you're seeing now. It's like hilarious. But then none of us were saints back then, and everybody's a saint now. At least, that's the way it looks. That's the style. I love how everyone's working so hard to be clean these days, and they're still getting scorched. And for what?
For nothing, compared to what used to go on. This is a crazy business. Hard times for party animals. You should talk to Eddie Reyes, the brother-in-law. He knew Freddy real good.
Was he the guy you did business with? Libby asked.
Everybody did business with Eddie, Figueroa said. He was just a real public-spirited individual.
I need a shower, Libby said as we headed south in the red Chrysler LeBaron convertible she had rented. Might as well live it up, she'd said. This'll be paid off 10 cents on the dollar by the defunct Stanton for President campaign.
Not much of a scandal, I said.
Fucking sleazeball, she said.
Her wild gray hair was blowing out behind her in the evening breeze.
I touched his hand. Yuck! Cooties!
So, we go to see Eddie Reyes, if he'll see us, I said.
Then what?
Potsy, she said. Lipinski's husband. Potsy was a statey. Stateys know everything.
We'll have a nice, quiet dinner with the Potter Lipinskis tomorrow night.
Libby had made room reservations at a place called Le Freak, an Art Deco hotel on the ocean in South Beach, which, it was immediately clear, had gotten high marks from Libby's favorite gay travel guide. It was a fabulous place, a carnal theme park. The bellboys were choice beefcake, dressed as native bearers, bare-chested in loincloths and sandals. This being a politically correct theme park, they came in all colors. The lobby was fantastic, way over the top, neo-buona style. All palms and rattan furniture with mud cloth cushions sitting on a giant leopard print rug. There were trickling fountains and rainforest vegetation and zebra skins, masks, spears, and thatch on the walls. The lobby bar had waiters wearing pith helmets and sarongs. Other servants wafted about offering party favors and waving palm frond fans. The pipe music, very low and seductive, was Olatunji and his drums of passion. Everyone seemed to be moving to the beat.
Bummer, Libby, stage whispered.
Too sedate, Lib? I asked.
I was expecting something more, bicoastal, she said as we followed the snaking slate path toward the registration desk.
At least,
That's what the guide said.
How disappointing, I said. So, do we have to stay here?
It's late. I'm wiped, Libby said.
And this is going to cost the Stanton campaign a shitload of money. They charge whorehouse rates in this joint.
The rooms were something of a comedown after the scene in the lobby. Mine was pink and bare, with 50s motel furniture. Another conceit, obviously. And jalousy windows facing the ocean. I flipped on the television, lay down on the bed, and felt antsy. I called Daisy, got her phone machine, and didn't leave a message. I went for a walk. On a side street off the ocean, I saw a crowd of young people, men and women, young and pretty, carrying pastel drinks and plastic glasses, spilling out from a club called the Awful Surge. I went inside and stood at the bar, which was bathed in cherry light and decorated with driftwood and seashells. I ordered a margarita with a double shot. A bar band wearing Hawaiian shirts was playing Beach Boys loud enough so that when you talked, you had to yell directly into the other person's ear. The ear I chose belonged to a woman who would have been one of my classic thermonuclear Holocaust fantasies on the E-train. Her name was either Claudia or Gloria. She was Latino, copper-skinned, wearing an aquamarine halter top and black bicycle shorts. She smiled at me. I smiled at her. I bought her a drink. We chatted, rudimentarily. She worked in a hotel. She asked me what I did. "Estate sales," I yelled. "What?" she asked. "I sell dead people's property," I said. "You from here?" she asked. "New York," I said, less confidently. "You want to dance?" We danced. Little Deuce Coupe and Surfer Girl. I am not a big Beach Boys fan. They'd always seemed an apotheosis of Caucasian dorkiness. And Surfer Girl may well be the stupidest song ever written, but it is very, very slow. And Claudia Gloria snuggled close, her hands at my neck, and I put my hands down by the small of her back, just where her hips flared, touching the soft skin between her halter top and bicycle shorts. "Where are you staying?" she whispered, her lips and a tiny hint of tongue on my ear.
Lafrique, I said.
"That's a faggot hotel," she said, pulling back, looking at me. "Are you?"
"No," I said. "And I can prove it."
I proved it, then promptly fell asleep, and awakened in the darkness. Claudia Gloria sleeping softly, facing me, her mouth slightly open, a complete stranger. I shoved back toward the edge of the bed and stared at her, searching for signs of familiarity. There were none. I was wide awake now, feeling slightly freaked, not quite guilty, but alone, and the aloneness was a physical state, a dull ache, and claustrophobic, too, in that bed. I got up and went to the windows. They were locked shut. I fumbled about, trying to crank them open, no luck. I could see occasional ruffles of white along the inky beachfront, waves breaking. I couldn't hear the ocean. I was cut off from it. Each of Claudia Gloria's breaths seemed to fill the room, pressing against me, pushing me out. I threw on my clothes and whipped through the lobby. Mostly empty now, though several bearers and buanas were engaged in heavy petting on the rattan couches in dark corners, and went out to the ocean, tremendously relieved by the warmth of the air and the fact that I could now hear the waves. I took several steps out into the sand, but it was squishy and uncomfortable, too much of an effort. And so I retreated to a bench on the grass strip near the sidewalk, beneath the palms, and I sat there, watching the ocean, watching the dawn come, my mind frozen, except for thoughts of Daisy and the sudden, intolerable emptiness of being alone. Eddie Reyes was a very busy man, but he agreed to see us late that afternoon. Libby also arranged for us to have dinner with Judy Lipinski and her husband, Ralph Potter, that evening, at Joe's Stone Crab. "So who was the girl?" Libby asked, as we drove across the causeway to Miami that afternoon.
"What girl?"
"Henry. You've known me for how long?"
We're fucking partners in crime, and you're still trying to game me? For God's sake, little man. You smell like sex. I got a nose for Nookie.
I looked at her.
Okay, she said. I called your room this morning, she answered. She said, tell your friend he's a nice guy, but it's only polite to say thank you and goodbye.
You booked on her, Henri? You fled?
Do we have to talk about this? I asked.
What else is there? Libby screeched.
You don't have much of a conversational repartee, Henry. There isn't too much we can talk about. You don't know shit about music. I've never heard you discuss science or philosophy or the wonders of East Asia. You're a stunted fucking little guy. Politics, politics, politics.
And there ain't much politics left for us now, is there?
We are at the end of politics.
So, what you got without politics, Henri? She said, suddenly quieting down for effect. You don't even have the courage to tell Daisy you love her.
Jesus, Libby, I said. Pathetic, Henry. I would like to be able to report that Eddie Reyes' office didn't look like something lifted directly out of Miami Vice. I would like to report that it wasn't all angles and starkness. But I can't. It was, and so was he. His bare rectangular desk, green marble on thin legs, stood in front of a dramatic isosceles triangle window. The room was irregularly shaped, acute, and unpredictable. The art, clashing with itself elegantly on soft, charcoal-gray walls, was solid geometry. A tangerine circle, a cerulean rhombus, a royal purple square. The floor was highly polished onyx plastic. Libby, in a fuchsia and chartreuse, tie-dyed muumuu, fit this place perfectly. I felt lost and a little giddy. Had serious, sentient humans ever conducted business here? Then again, I imagined how we, Libby and I, probably looked to Eddie Reyes. Several exits past Sirius. That was for damn sure. Eddie was wearing a white linen suit and a creamy white silk shirt, opened several buttons down, a gold cross nestled in his hairy chest. He had a slight paunch. His hair was dark and straight, but not oiled. His sideburns were bushy and turning gray. He wore a Rolex with a heavy gold band, a wedding ring, a diamond stud earring. His secretary, a tall woman impeccably dressed in a white blouse, tight gray skirt, the color of the walls, and black heels, served us Perrier in triangular glasses. We sat in two very austere chrome and black leather chairs facing the desk. Eddie stood. There was no chair behind the desk. This was a room for audiences, not paperwork. So, Eddie said, with the confidence of a man used to being the smartest person in a room, Rusty Figueroa has spilled the beans. He once took a campaign contribution from Sunshine Associates. Shocking, don't you think? I hope you won't be too disappointed if I confess everything immediately. A terrible crime, giving campaign contributions.
It's not the money, Libby said. It's who gave it and why.
I gave it, Eddie said, because I found Rusty Figueroa's philosophy of governance enlightened. Oh, there were some specific policy differences, but... You were in business with the governor's wife and the governor's brother, Libby said. You were trying to get action on a specific project from the state.
Yes, I was in business with my sister and the governor's idiot brother, Eddie replied sharply. As for the action, prove it.
I don't have to, Libby said. It's going to look like shit.
I am absolutely heartbroken about that, Ms. Holden, he said derisively. I had so wished that Freddie would get to be president. Then, diving into a cruder, faster tone, but I must say, if the motherfucker has to go down, it would be just too fucking perfect that he'd go down over a nothing piece of shit like this. It would be more appropriate than you can imagine. I'll even tell you why.
Yes, Tony and I had this business. Yes, we hired that idiot, Andy Picker, after he drove his family's business into the ground. And yes, I hoped that having the governor as a brother-in-law wouldn't be a liability. But it was.
Eddie Reyes sat down on the edge of his desk, leaned toward us. See, the Pickers were broke. Andy was as bad at trading leases as Freddie was good. Poppy didn't want Tony to be broke, too. So he told me to take care of her, and yeah, I thought I'd be able to make a little dough for myself in the process. Money was falling from the clouds in those days.
but Senor Recto, Mr. Righteous, Governor Picker, he wouldn't cut me any slack. There was a shitload of Section 8 money just lying around. I had a fucking consortium ready to roll, and Freddy said, no way. Reyes got up off the desk, began prowling the room. So yeah, we did do Tidewater. We did it straight up. We did it like every other fucking condo. And that motherfucker still wanted to line item veto it. I'll bet Rusty didn't tell you that. It was just fucking spectacular that Freddy could be so straight and so bent at the same time. It was practically acrobatic, a wonder of modern science. And so yes, yeah, absolutely. Tony did eventually convince him to treat Tidewater just like every other fucking project. But I gotta tell you, the story here isn't what we did, but what we didn't do. What he stopped us from doing. There wasn't much we could say to that. Eddie seemed almost disappointed that we didn't have more questions. He stopped pacing, shook his head. Senor Recto, Mr. Recto, Mr. Asshole. He laughed. Mr. President? This is one fabulous fucking country, you know that? But he didn't stop you from going into business like that, Libby tried, flustered for once, groping. You hired his wife, his brother, and he didn't stop you. He must have known. Known? Eddie scoffed. What the fuck did he know? He was half stoned most of the time. Stoned? Libby blurted. Oh, dear, Edgardo Reyes said, putting his hands beside his cheeks and rolling his eyes, viciously mocking Monk. I really have gone and said something I oughtn't, haven't I? Stoned? How? Toot, toot, tootsie, goodbye, Eddie sang. Toot, toot, tootsie, don't cry. You look disappointed, he said, reading our faces too well. Fucking marijuana cokehead. Wait a minute, Libby said. Cocaine, Eddie said. He loved the shit. Hell, we all love the shit. But he's the only one of us who's a candidate for sainthood. It doesn't fit, I said, shocked and sickened by this, and angry with Eddie Reyes for pushing this in our faces. With the current Senator Recto, no way it fits Chiquito, Eddie purred. You see him on the tube and he's practically a virgin. But how old are you? Where were you 20 years ago? In diapers? You ought to understand, he said, turning to Libby. Are you the same now you were 20 years ago?
Abso-fucking-lutely, Libby said.
Eddie looked at her and laughed. I'll bet you are, he said.
I just look a little different, she added. But you do remember when everyone was doing everything, right? Eddie continued. You remember when people were saying cocaine was about as dangerous as marijuana? Or it was down here. They were even tooting up in the White House.
And then he softened a bit. Look, I ain't gonna testify against Freddy. I ain't gonna say a word. You were reporters? I'd have given you my Tidewater rap and then sent you home. But I'm not the only guy in town. There are folks who might want to make a fortune selling this to the National Flash. If your guy Stanton's a real shit, he'll reach out and touch someone. Put in a call. Start the ball rolling. I guess you guys know all about how that works. And I will fucking weep when Freddy goes down, because it will reflect back on my sister, who has put her life together okay now, and on my nephews. But he should have never gotten back into the game. He made the right choice when he quit in 78. Came damn close to having his cover blown from what I hear. He should have left well enough alone. But down he will go. This is America. You can bank on it. I don't believe it, I said in the car, heading back across the causeway. He's just trying to lead us off the scent.
Oh, shit, Henry. Why would he even bother? Libby said dismissively. He's not at risk in any way. Even if Freddy did all the things Reyes said he didn't do, even if he quietly helped to make his wife and brother a fortune, Eddie's still clean. He was just a businessman, just doing business. But Picker is fucked either way. If he didn't do anything bent, it still looks like shit. It still looks like 4,000 man-hours of investigative reporting, and Lord knows how many column inches of bullshit when the scorps get wind. And even if they don't come up with a scintilla of a fart in the end, Henry, baby, the mere fact that they were looking, The mere fact that Sunshine existed, with Picker's wife and his brother and his brother-in-law turning any sort of profit at all, is going to come off just marginally more benign than if Freddie had personally knocked off half the banks in Tampa. Henry, this is the world we inhabit. This is our lives. This is what we've been living the past few months. Why should Picker be immune? Alleged is an indictment in a political campaign. So, yeah, I don't think the cocaine stuff was Eddie working any detour.
Then what? I asked. It was weird. It was just so gratuitous.
Payback can be therapeutic, Libby said. You gotta figure Eddie's been storing up a shitload of pissed-offedness ever since Freddie went recto on him. And you gotta say, he's got a point. If Freddie was snowed in. I mean, drugs, but no deals. A very bent sort of integrity. I suppose you gotta admire it.
You think it's true?
Well, you look at Freddie Picker back then, you look at the videotape, and he sure was a bouncy little fucker, Libby said. Then, Henry, you are an open fucking book. Always were. You're rooting for Picker.
And what are you doing?
I'm conducting a scientific experiment, she said. I am the Marie Curie of the shit world.
Libby, we've busted enough dust, I said. Why can't we go home now?
We've got to see it through, she said. I will not consider this a satisfying personal experience unless we know exactly what Freddie Picker did and who he did it to, even if, she added, I'll be disappointed to learn it.
But it'd take weeks, if ever, I said.
How quickly, Henri, did we nail that shitbird Cashmere?
About as fast as the governor did, most likely, I said, surprising myself. I'd never made a joke at Jack Stanton's expense before.
Henry Burton, irreverence? Your conversational repertoire is like exploding before my very eyes. If you could start discoursing, no, not even that, just like personal opinions on Brahms' German Requiem, or maybe why you think Beethoven couldn't do opera. Does grunge have legs? Anything? You do that, we could go into business, be partners, like Starsky and Hutch. And I wouldn't be bored. It would be a life.
Have you ever read Middlemarch? I asked.
George Eliot, she said. How could such a smart woman have such a fucking pathetic self-destructive sex life?
It was the 19th century, I said.
She was a rebel. She broke rules, Libby said. And she weenied out on her own life.
But then, who am I to talk?
Shit, Libby, I said. Let's go home. What else can we do here?
Ralphie will know.
Well, yeah,
Ralph Potter said, hammering a crab claw and looking slightly ridiculous in his plastic bib. He was a classic state trooper, big and buzz cut, but with some irony in the crow's feet. There were rumors he was a junkie. There were rumors he was fucking around on her, and vice versa. There were rumors he was gay, there were rumors she was gay, Judy Lipinski said. That was one crazy time. Coke had just come in, and it was a monster. And yeah, I guess the governor was down here a lot. He made the scene. It didn't seem like such a big deal. In the old days, it was okay for politicians to make the scene. She, the wife, was from here, and who wants to stay in Tallahassee if you're not under duress? I was drifting, fighting off sleep, picking at a seafood salad. I hadn't gotten much rest the night before. This was a very noisy restaurant. No problem for Judy or Libby, who could be heard in an avalanche. But Ralph spoke softly, slowly, and you had to strain to hear him.
Ralphie, Libby asked, what sort of rumors?
What you said, he said. Drugs.
What flavor? Libby asked.
Just what you said, he said, irritated. He knew something, and since he was willing, however reluctantly, to show that he knew something, Libby was sure to find out what it was. This was a negotiation. They were negotiating over discretion. Ralph was saying, okay, I'll tell you, but I don't like this. I'm only doing this because you're an old friend, and you better be goddamn careful. And Libby was saying, I'll protect you and your source, but we both know you're going to tell me. She was saying this by not saying anything, by just staring at him, twirling great fork loads of linguine with seafood and allowing the quiet to settle in.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Ralphie, Judy finally said.
There's a guy, Ralph said after another chastening moment of silence, directed mostly at his wife.
Libby stared at him.
A former statey. Libby twirled and stared. Named Reggie Du Bois, Ralph said.
And? Judy asked. This was her interrogation now.
He was detailed to the governor whenever the governor came to Miami, Ralph said. He was Picker's driver. He had a problem. He owes me a little.
What kind of problem? Judy asked.
A running nose, Ralph said, eyes narrowing, angry with his wife. I was his superior. He came to me all fucked up. He needed help. And I got him a quiet little leave, with the understanding that he'd resign as soon as he got his problem taken care of.
Why the break? Libby asked.
He was a good man, Ralph said. And a lot of fucked up things were going down in those days, as you said. I made a judgment that he'd made a mistake and could get himself clean. I don't think humiliation would help him any.
Judy came halfway out of her chair, threw her arms around Ralph's neck, and gave him a long, passionate kiss on the mouth. She turned to Libby. See, she said, it wasn't his badge or his gun.
Libby nodded. Touché.
So, where is he now? She asked.
Doing community work, Ralph said. They call him the Mayor of Liberty City.
We found the Mayor of Liberty City in a garbage-strewn vacant lot on Saturday morning with about 10 12-year-olds wearing bright yellow baseball hats and holding large green litter bags. He was an imposing black man, a huge upper torso precarious on long, thin legs, with a gray beard and furious eyes. He was wearing a Nelson Mandela t-shirt and khaki bush shorts.
Welcome to the Little Negro Leagues, he said when Libby and I pulled up. This is spring training. We clear the field, we cut a diamond. If we build it, they may come.
We'll help, Libby volunteered.
And we did, for several hours. And it felt very good. Something actually got done. It was a hot, clear morning that drifted from tolerable to bleach white as the sun dragged itself to the top of the sky.
We stopped every half hour or so and gave the kids fruit juice in small paper cups.
Libby quickly flushed salmon pink. Huge, dark crescents of sweat radiated out from her armpits, turning her enormous olive shift black. I was drenched and dusty as well, but not quite so spectacularly. I lost myself in the work. The first sustained physical labor I'd done, and I couldn't remember how long. I didn't pay much attention to the kids, certainly not as much as Libby, who tried, without much luck, to lead them in a Smokey Robinson's Greatest Hits sing-along. Most were too young to know the songs. By noon, the lot was cleared, a pyramid of green litter bags triumphant on the sidewalk.
You want to come back next week and rake?
Reggie Du Bois asked, after sending the kids home.
Or are you going to be too busy destroying a friend of mine?
Where do you want to talk about it? Libby asked.
No fucking where, Reggie said. But there's a McDonald's a few blocks down, and it's air-conditioned.
Du Bois ordered himself several Big Macs. Libby ordered herself several quarter-pounders with cheese. I had a medium Diet Coke, which tasted like liquid cardboard.
You know, Libby said, I've never understood why they don't do a Mac with the quarter-pounder patties.
Fuck you, Du Bois said.
McDonald's wasn't built for people his size. He and Libby, sitting in the same booth, represented a serious population problem, but he was working the discomfort angle. He didn't want us to feel too easy about our work.
And you know what else? He said, taking a fierce, noisy, climactic sip from his Coke. Fuck you. I just want to make my utter disgust perfectly clear. I also want it clear that I will never say a public word against Freddie Picker. In fact, I will fucking deny everything I tell you now. I'm only doing this shit because I owe Ralph Potter my life, and he asked me to cooperate. And he ain't asked a thing from me from the day he saved my life until now. But I want you to know, and he looked at me very evenly, I think you're scum.
You drove for the governor? Libby asked.
Yeah, he said, and it was a fucking privilege.
Why?
Because he was a decent human being who got caught up in something he didn't expect.
Which was cocaine?
None of us had any idea what it was, except it made you feel like God, and the governor would score. And you know, I don't know how it started, how it became clear to us that we were both into the shit. Maybe it was just that everyone was into it then. Maybe you just saw it in each other's eyes. But at some point it was clear. It wasn't grotesque. He wasn't like me. I was a fucking animal. But I never thought he was as fucked up as me. You know how it is? You're always doing junky trigonometry. I am more fucked up than A, but less fucked up than B. I thought he controlled it pretty well. But then, what do I know? I always imagined him living a father-knows-best life up in Tallahassee, then coming down here to take vacations from having to be perfect. I never asked myself, why is this guy messing with his life this way? When you're a cop, you don't look for explanations of people fucking up. You just assume it. People fuck up. But there are amateurs and professionals. The governor fucked up like an amateur.
Where would he score? Libby asked gently.
There was a guy.
The same guy, always?
Yeah. Lorenzo Delgado, upper-class Cuban, a lawyer, I think. Lived in a classy old building in Coral Gables. Another amateur, at first. I think he and the governor knew each other socially, met through the wife's crowd. But Lorenzo got snowblind real bad. He began to deal, and deal heavily enough to draw attention. Libby didn't say anything.
Yeah, yeah, Reggie Dubois said. I saved the governor's ass.
I was down in the car. He was up with Renzo. Sometimes you just get lucky. A narc you once knew will stroll up to the car, the governor's car, and say, I'm not so sure you want to be in this neighborhood. It's not safe. So I run upstairs and I found them. And I say to the governor, Stevie is calling you. Something urgent up north. Stevie was his chief of staff, and we got out of there just in time, and it kind of focused the mind. He sat in the back seat of the car, and he began to cry, his hand up over his eyes, and I sat in the front seat crying too. And you know, I didn't know what to do, what to say, because we'd never really said anything in the first place. We had no vocabulary for this shit. I just got in the fuck out of there as fast as I could to the airport, out. They opened the door for him, and we just looked at each other. Our eyes met, and we didn't say anything. But I knew we were both thinking the same thing. Is this who we are? The boys gathered all the sandwich wrappings and placed them neatly on the tray. He policed the area. And then, he continued, I went and found Potter and told him everything except for the part about the governor, and he said, Reggie, you're a good cop. Take yourself a leave of absence, get cleaned up, and then I don't ever want to see you around the state barracks again. I was lucky that way. Luckier than the governor. There was no Ralph Potter for him to go to, and I think he needed someone. He quit the job a few weeks after that, the press conference you keep seeing on the news. I never saw him again.
And the dealer?
Libby asked. Busted. Guilty. Gone. Never heard nothing about him again either. We sat there quietly for a few minutes, no one knowing what to do or say next. I don't know what you people do with this sort of thing, Reggie Dubois finally said. And as I said, I'm not going to be any part of it. But if you use this to take Freddy Picker down, you should die slowly from cancer. Unless you can look yourself in the mirror and say there wasn't a moment in your life when you didn't do the wrong thing, when you didn't get a little mixed up, head off on the wrong path. The good Lord gives us a precious ration of those. We're each allowed a few. My grandmother, who came down here from cane-cutting country, had this thing she'd say. Every saint has a past. Every sinner has a future. I try to remember that when folks in this neighborhood start treating me like a role model, start hedging their language and acting like I'm better than they are, like they can't behave normal around me. And I try to look at the fucked up kids around here the same way Ralph Potter looked at me. At least, when they're still fresh at being evil. I don't assume they're lost.
I give him a tough chance back. But nobody gets that sort of slack in your line of work, do they? One strike and you're out. He shook his head and laughed. I guess your drug is a lot more dangerous than mine was.
There was one last favor to ask of Ralph Potter. Libby called him from the lobby of the Intercontinental Hotel in Miami, still sweaty and dusty from Liberty City, and drawing stares. We used the bathrooms to wash and change, then sat out on the patio for an hour, drinking iced tea. Finally, Libby called Ralph again. Lorenzo Delgado was released from prison 9 months ago, she said when she returned. He's living at this address, a halfway house in Hialeah. We arrived there in late afternoon. It was different from the other houses in the neighborhood, which were small, low, painted in Caribbean pastels, teeming with children and music and immigrant optimism. The halfway house was older and more austere. All the windows were closed and the shades drawn. It was a large house, two stories, white shingles and a tin roof, a remnant from an earlier time. The dirt yard had been carefully raked. There were no footprints. There was a sign above the door, El Camino al Paraíso. We rang the bell and were buzzed in. It was cool inside, over-air-conditioned, with a heavy institutional disinfectant smell. The entrance hall ceiling was painted, remarkably, in dark blue, with small stars and subtle, discreetly placed angels. There were two posters on the wall, a flowery One Day at a Time, and a more militant photo of a gay pride march with the words, We're here, get used to it. A chunky Hispanic woman sat in the office reading a novella. She directed us upstairs to the sun porch. That's where Renzo usually hangs. We walked through a common room filled with secondhand furniture, dominated by a big-screen color television. Three men sat watching a Spanish soap opera. One had the distinctive purplish festers of Kaposi's sarcoma. Another was bundled in a sweater, glassy-eyed and coughing. The third was tethered to an intravenous pole. Upstairs was a narrow, depressing hallway, studded with doorways on both sides. The porch was at the end of the hall, through an aluminum storm door. It was enclosed by screens, pleasant, warmer than inside, and feathered by a light breeze. Lorenzo Delgado was alone there. He was a small, thin man, sitting on a chaise, smoking a Marlboro.
You're Renzo? Libby asked. He nodded.
We'd like to talk to you about Freddie Picker.
Oh, I've been expecting you. You're from the campaign, right?
He asked, but rattled on before we had a chance, God forgive us, to say which campaign.
Well, you can tell Freddie has nothing to fear from me, he said in a hoarse, gravelly voice. Nothing. You understand? This happened after. I thugged my brains out in jail. Not much else to do there. And there were so many boys who spent all day in the gym working on their bodies.
Libby and I didn't dare look at each other, much less say anything. We flanked him in aluminum lawn chairs.
I like this porch, he said. But I can't do it all the time. Depends on the weather. It's strange. My body temperature is always off one way or another. Too hot or too cold. It never feels just right. Sometimes the tiniest breeze can set me off, shivering, and I can't do anything about it. Can't turn it off, just have to ride with it.
I still hadn't said anything, hadn't introduced myself, and Renzo suddenly fixed on me. He appeared to check me out, a salacious glance, then he smiled and asked,
So, are you Freddy's friend now?
Ooh-wee! Libby said as we headed for the airport. You just knew it was going to be good. You just knew it was going to be irresistible. And this has every fucking thing. Sex, drugs, corruption. And none of it, Henry, my man, none of it is clear-cut vanility. It's all kind of human and lovely and luscious. It's weakness, not evil. I love this game.
What are you talking about? I asked.
When doing a social experiment,
Libby said, going into a high-pitched Julia Child impersonation,
you do not want to start gently. You want to roil the fucker. You want conditions right. You want it to be really tempting, you know? You want it luscious. This is dripping with electricity.
But I don't understand. Oh, Henry, of course you understand. We've been on the same fucking page from the start. If you hadn't been, I'd have told you to stuff it, stay home, be a lackey. So don't play dumb with me. This is a test of us and them. Actually, of us and them and us again. We just passed the entrance exam. We got the dirt. We're fucking unbelievable, you know that? We're so good, we're lucky. Libby, what are you talking about? I asked, but I kind of knew. What are we gonna do with this shit?
It ain't us. It ain't what we're gonna do. It ain't about us.
She slammed the horn on us. It's now about them. We are going to do what we do. We bust, dust, and tell all. The question is, what are Jack and Susan going to do with it? Inquiring minds want to know. I mean, little buddy, isn't that really what we're both after here? I mean, after 20 fucking years, I get to see what they're about. Not just hypothesize, not just hope. This is it. Graduation day. They graduate, or I do. Tell the truth, Henry, she said, and dived into an intense whisper, staring at me with wild blue eyes instead of at the road. Isn't this what you're really after, too?
Drive, Libby, goddammit,
I said.
Well, isn't it?
I guess, I said, but I knew. What if they react the wrong way? What if they flunk the test?
Then it's our turn at bat again, she said.
Hoo-ha! Then we get to see what we're made of, and we gotta hope it ain't green cheese.
Libby, I said, I know this is hard, but I've seen you do it before. Could you please possibly get fucking sane for a minute and tell me what you're getting me into?
No,
she said, and swerved the car onto the shoulder, slamming the brakes, stopping with a lurch.
Jesus, I said.
Henry, she said, staring at me, perfectly calm, perfectly sane. I had done it. Do you remember the rules we set the day we vamped on that scumfucker Randy Culligan? Do you remember how we were sitting outside his law office and I told you I was about to do something crazy? And you could be in or out, but ask no questions? I nodded. Well, sweetie, she said, taking my chin in her hand, we're back there now. Faith or nothing. You on? You're not going to shoot the Stantons, are you?
Not quite, she said.
No violence of any kind?
Don't chivy me, Henry, she said. You on or no?
I nodded yes, my chin still in her hand, and she kissed me on the cheek. The Sunday morning papers had Freddie Picker being endorsed by the governor of Pennsylvania and most of the state's congressional delegation. I read it as a civilian might, without a twinge. There had been days, months, when I could soar or dive on the hint of a nuance in a one-paragraph item buried in the Washington Post. That had been my life, but the campaign was over for me now. I called Daisy that morning and got her machine again.
Daisy, please, I said. I fucked up. But does one fuck-up mean that I'm cast into the outer darkness for all eternity? I miss you.
Libby called later that morning. We meet at 5 at the mansion, just before the other meeting, which is, you're never fucking going to believe this, a dinner meeting, and Fat Willie is catering. I guess Jack figures, if he's going out, might as well go out with a full belly.
Did he ask you anything?
Does a woodpecker have a long, sharp nose? And, oh, ye of little faith. Well, what did you say?
He said, any luck?
I said, depends on what you mean by luck. He said,
did you find anything?
I said, depends on what you mean by anything. He said,
come on, Libby, don't fuck with me.
I said, I don't fuck, I make love. You aren't gonna risk another moment of passion now, Jack, after all the shit your wiener's gotten you into, are you?
So the question is, he call you yet?
No, I said,
he will. He did, about 10 minutes after I got off with Libby.
So, how was Florida?
He asked.
Humid, I said.
Oh, come on, Henry. Not you too.
I didn't say anything.
I need to know if there's any hope, he said.
I carefully considered what I said next.
It depends, I said. What do you mean by hope?
Henry, goddammit, who are you working for?
Governor, I'm working with Libby, I said. We figured it would be best if we made our report together. See you at 5. I spent the next few hours taking inventory of my apartment, trying to figure out how much there would be to pack, how long it would take to leave. Then I went for a run and, afterward, sat on a bench next to the river, which was swollen with a spring, heavy with grassy banks, soggy. Of all the things I had seen and done and experienced in Mammoth Falls, I would remember the river most vividly. It was the closest I'd ever come to a natural thing. I lived next to it, ran alongside it, sat beside it, slowly learned its moods. And there were times that I could put myself in a half-trance and imagine its swift current emptying my mind, carrying my worries off downstream. I never stopped to consider the transcendental power of the river. I'm not very mystical, I guess. But I do find myself sitting in that spot, in my mind from time to time, especially when I'm looking to get calm. Howard and Lucille were there with the Stantons in the study when I arrived, which was a matter of some concern. Howard telegraphed one of his furtive little ironic smiles. Lucille glared. Susan stood, gave me a kiss on the cheek, and said, "What? You didn't bring us back any jelly?" She turned to Jack and asked, "Hey, did I ever tell you about this? Whenever my folks came back from Florida, they brought me a package. 3 glass globes, globules, of jelly. One was orange, another orange pineapple, another chi-
Out!"
It was Libby, pointing a finger, casually and from above, like God in the Sistine Chapel, at Lucille.
"You are out of here, you slime-tutinous sack of snail-wuzzle! And you too, you especially too," she said, whirling on Howard. "Life is too fucking short to even have to think about your sorry ass. Out!"
Neither moved. Howard looked at Jack, Lucille, Susan.
"Okay,"
Libby said and turned toward the door.
"No, wait,"
Susan said, nodding toward Lucille, who began moving toward the door, then stopped, put her hands on her hips, and said to Libby,
"You are one sick puppy."
"Ha, ha, 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 ha,"
Libby said, throwing her head back and not laughing.
"Out, out, out, out,"
she said, barking like a dog. Then to Howard,
"You, too, teeny weeny, time to book. You're leaving on that midnight train to Georgia. Out, 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 out. I've had 20 fucking years too much of you."
"Can I stay?" Susan asked, as Howard left, closing the study door behind him.
"Always," Libby smiled. "Sweetheart."
"Is all this really necessary?" Jack asked.
"No,"
Libby said, then added with a sudden Scottish burr,
"but it's what happens when you send a lunatic to do a man's work. So here, Governor, feast your eyes,"
she said, tossing Stanton, who was sitting in his usual wing chair, a manila legal file with a metal clasp at the top.
"You too, m'lady."
She handed a file to Susan, who was curled barefoot down the other end of the green couch from me. Then Libby handed me a copy, accompanied by a small sigh and a clear-eyed, "here goes nothing" glance. As we read, she paced the edge of the room, next to the windows, hands clasped behind her back, head down, rifling the gauzy linen curtains as she passed. The file was untitled. The first page said, "Executive Summary." It had a row of bullets, setting off capitalized names. Orestes Figueroa, Edgardo Reyes, Reginald Du Bois, Lorenzo Delgado, and a precise, one-sentence summary of their testimony. This was followed by more elaborate accounts of our interviews with the four, accounts that seemed entirely accurate, unhedged, unbiased, to me. Jack Stanton whistled and looked up. Libby said, "Henry, does this square with your memory of the investigations?"
"Yes, absolutely."
"Remarkable," Stanton said, shaking his head. "How on earth did he ever think he could get away with this?"
"Well, he was running against you," Libby said. Stanton ignored that.
"What do we do with this?"
he asked.
The Times, Susan said. Or maybe the Wall Street Journal. More authoritative, in a way.
Libby glanced at me. They hadn't even hesitated. Not an instant of doubt.
Through an intermediary, Susan said. Someone not associated with the campaign.
I don't think so, Libby said.
What do you mean?
Stanton said, twisting around back toward a corner of the room behind the wing chair, where Libby leaned against a grandfather clock, positioning herself for his discomfort.
I don't think there's anything of use here, she said.
Come on, Libby, you gotta be kidding, Stanton said. At the very least, the Republicans already know about the sunshine business, and the rest is eminently gettable, soon as people start looking for it.
Maybe, said Libby, sliding down to the floor, knees up, palms on her knees next to the grandfather clock. Stan couldn't see her at all now. He had to get up and turn around, a knee on the wing chair.
But it doesn't meet my standards, she said.
What on earth do you mean, Olivia? Susan asked, sardonically.
I mean, madame, two things, Libby said, popping up, pacing again.
First of all, this is mostly bullshit. It's horfslop, an innuendo. The sunshine business looks bad, but I don't think Freddie had all that much to do with it. As for the rest, well, Reggie Du Bois ain't gonna talk, God bless him, and Renzo, she stopped, staring directly at Susan.
You wouldn't dare.
She moved around the couch directly behind me, put her hands on my shoulders. Besides legal eagles, point two is dispositive. Henry and I don't think the use of this material is proper. We have a moral objection, and I have a historical beef.
Stanton glanced at me. I gave him nothing back. The same cold void I'd once given Fat Willie on his behalf.
Oh, come on, Libby, he said. If you weren't going to use it, why'd you go look for it?
He could have been a real shit, she said, resuming her pacing. I didn't think he would be, and he isn't. But he could have been. But Jackie, my dearest, you are off the fucking point. The point is, we don't do this sort of thing. Oh, I will be relentless, busting dust and guarding your ass. I'd have even blown Randy Culligan's weenie off for you. Well, maybe I would have. But this is something else again. This is hurting someone else. This sucks. You want to know exactly why this sucks? Because you told me so. You remember when, Jackie? Let me refresh your memory. And she dived into her leather satchel and produced three copies of an 8x10 black and white photo, which she handed to Jack, Susan, and me.
It was remarkable. Jack and Susan looked pretty much the same, but younger, fresher. They were dressed in turn-of-the-70s clothes. Jack's hair was long and curly. He was wearing a ruffled Edwardian shirt with a laced drawstring top, sort of like Errol Flynn, and bell-bottoms. Susan's hair was long, straight, and brown. She was wearing a bikini top and very short cut-off jeans. Both Stantons were wearing sandals. The real revelation, though, was Libby, who stood in the middle, an arm around Jack and Susan, towering over both, smiling with proud parental satisfaction. My first thought was, why did Libby seem so tall? Then I realized she was wearing heels. She was, in fact, very conventionally dressed, and about 100 pounds thinner. She had big hair, not yet gray, and was wearing a satiny sheath, and looked like a Kilgore Junior College rangerette. Or maybe one of Lyndon Johnson's daughters.
Henry, weren't you just gorgeous? She sighed.
Yeah, I said, but look at you.
You little shit, she said. I told you I used to have a waist.
Libby, Jack began.
Oh, hush up, she said. Don't ruin it. You remember when this was? She looked at Stanton. You don't, do you? The Miami headquarters in 72, Susan said.
Well, of course, Libby said.
Henry, this was taken just after the convention. I'll never forget that convention. I was already running Florida, and Gary Hart finds me in a trailer, on a phone, whipping my delegation, and he has these guys. Oh, he said. He called me Oh. I brought some reinforcements. And it was like, wow. They were golden, you know? A different life form. I mean,
It was just clear as day as soon as they settled in. They were geniuses at this shit. We had a crampy old subtropical piece of shit office in downtown Miami, and the Stantons were, well, this picture was taken the day they reported to work. God, they almost turned it into a real campaign. Jack was out talking to groups, all these old Jews and new dealers, none of whom wanted to support George McGovern and the forces of drugged fucking anarchy. But Jack would recite FDR's first inaugural by heart, bringing a tear to their eye. And then he'd say, "The Democratic Party has given you a good life. Would you be here? Would you be able to afford living here without Social Security? Are you willing to gamble your future, your children's future, on the people who fought against Social Security and Medicare and the GI Bill and every other thing that has made your lives a little better?"
"Probably swung 6 or 8 dozen votes," Stanton said.
"And Susan, map woman," Libby said. "She laid out the state, had every precinct organized, had the office running like a fucking harvesting combine. Of course, the Stantons brought along some seaweed and shit in their wake. Howard and Lucille, the Progressive Labor Party's fun couple of 1971. But with the Stantons, the deal has always been, you take the bad with the spectacular."
"Libby, for Christ's sake," Susan said. "What are you doing? What's the point?"
"The point is Eagleton," Libby said. "You remember, Jack? I must have known you, what, 2 days then? We hear about the electroshock, and it's weird. That was the first time I actually considered the possibility that we might lose to that fuckbrain Nixon. Before that, I was absolutely convinced we would win. I mean, who would ever vote for Tricky? No one I knew, except the idiots I escaped from back in Partridge, Texas. Can you imagine, Henry? We were so fucking young. And this one," she nodded over toward Stanton. "He takes me out. We go to this little open-air Cuban joint, and I've got my head in my hands. Life has ended, and they did it. The CIA. It had to be the CIA. I couldn't believe that Tom Eagleton would really be a nutcase. They had to have dragged him off and drugged him and made him crazy. It couldn't have been that McGovern was just a complete fucking amateur. No, they did dirty tricks. And I said to Jack, we gotta get the capability. You remember, Jack? We gotta be able to do that, too. And you said,
no. Our job is to end all that. Our job is to make it clean, because if it's clean, we win, because our ideas are better.
You remember that, Jack?"
Libby had tears in her eyes now.
"It was a long time ago," Stanton said gently.
"Libby, you said it yourself," Susan said coolly. "We were young. We didn't know how the world worked. Now we know. We know that if we don't move on this picker situation, 2 things will happen. The first is we're dead. Everything we've worked for since Miami 20 years ago dies, and fast. It will die tomorrow. The second thing that happens is someday soon, when the bloom is off the romance, when they've gotten sick of Freddie Picker's quiet, righteous act, when they want to pull his wings off, some enterprising journalist will stumble onto this, and if he doesn't, the Republicans will lead him to it. On their timetable next fall, it will be another Eagleton. Only it'll be our fault this time for letting it happen. Your fault, Libby." This was, I thought, a pretty strong argument. Libby didn't. "Honey," she said, "you may be right, but it just ain't who we're supposed to be."
"Maybe," Stanton said, "we could leak part of it, the sunshine stuff. We know the Republicans have that."
"Oh, Christ, Jack," Susan said, angry that he was softening. "You don't think they're going to have the rest soon enough? You don't think Eddie Reyes is going to do a whoops with someone else? You don't think he's going to spill it all? I mean," she rifled through Libby's file. "Libby, he did call Picker American cokehead, didn't he?" Libby and I exchanged a glance. "Yes, he had. We just dismissed it as another stray expletive at the time."
"So you'd even give up the Renzo angle?" Libby asked. "What fucking difference does orientation make?"
"It'll mean something to the National Flash," Susan said.
"Oh, Susie," Libby moaned. "You of all people."
Libby caught my surprise.
"Oh, come on, Henry. You of all people.
Remember what Eddie Reyes said? You should always assume everyone did everything back then. And Henry,
Surely you are familiar with Mrs. Stanton's need for physical solace in times of spousal despair. Now it was Jack Stanton's turn to be shocked. He shot a furious look at Libby, who smiled, then at Susan, who was blushing, then at me, too stunned to blush. We had all betrayed him, and he, of course, us. Evidently, everyone still did everything.
Children, children, Libby said, shaking her head, surveying the room. Ain't we got fun?
This has gone far enough, Stanton said. We have to decide.
What's to decide? Susan asked.
Correct, Libby said. There is nothing to decide. A decision has been made by me and Henri. This dies here.
I don't think so, Susan said.
I'm sorry, sweetheart, Libby said, but it does, and here's why.
She dived down into her satchel again and pulled out another manila file, which looked very much like the first.
I won't distribute this one. I didn't want to make copies, she said, nervously, I thought.
But I'll tell you what it is, and Jackie here can vouch for its accuracy. Silence, Governor, will signify assent.
Susan glanced at Jack. What's this look?
I guess life is still simple in the small towns of America, Libby began quietly. A doctor's office isn't very hard to get into after hours.
And, Susan, when you told me I was on the McAllister case, and when I heard that Jack had had his blood taken, I figured I had no choice but to investigate the matter fully.
Stanton paled. His right hand came up. He didn't know what to do with it, so he put it flat on top of his head.
Doc Hastings kept very detailed notes about your case over the years, Libby said. I guess he had a rooting interest. I mean, he was a full-service family practitioner, wasn't he? Oh, I never thought to ask. Does Susan know?
Stanton nodded yes.
Well, then, it's only Henry. And he knows everything else, so why not this?
She turned to me.
Doc Hastings is Governor Stanton's natural father. Mama used that Kansas City nonsense as a cover, and it worked real good, since Will Stanton never came back from Iwo to say otherwise. Mama told Jack about it when? Doctor's records say that you and he had a heart-to-heart after you graduated college. And being thoughtful folks, Jack and Mama kept it quiet, out of respect for Doc's wife and his two other boys. And also out of respect for Mama's reputation. Stanton stared at his lap. Susan stared at me. I stared into space. This was dog patch.
Libby read my mind.
Yeah, Henry, this is who we are, Jackie and me, Piney Woods pig pokers, right, Jack? Rule number one, if it moves, shoot it. Or fuck it, especially if it's family. It's a wonder Mama wasn't Doc Hastings' cousin.
Libby, Susan said, you're out of control.
Yeah, she agreed, taking a deep breath, calming herself. I'm sorry. Where was I?
She moved forward and squatted directly in front of Stanton's wing chair.
So Doc Hastings did have a rooting interest, didn't he? And root he did. Lord, Jackie, the machinations he went through to keep you out of the draft. The part I like best is the most recent stuff. Having Uncle Charlie take that blood test for you. I mean, would you actually have gone through with it, letting Uncle Charlie take the fall as the daddy? You think that would have been credible? What kind of shit is that?
Stanton moved his right hand from the top of his head to his brow, shading his eyes. He was embarrassed. I had never seen him like this before. He was always so unabashed, so aggressively in the world, dominating every conversation, every room, even when he was just listening. But Libby had punctured that. She was in control here. The governor was in full retreat. He appeared to squirrel down deeper into his chair, trapped, with Libby in hot pursuit, down on her knees in front of him, peering up, trying to make eye contact.
What kind of shit is that, Jack? She chided him gently, but with an edge of impatience. Oh, excuse me, I forgot. It's the same old shit. There's always been a Doc Hastings, or a Senator Lamont Dawson, or Uncle Charlie, or Susan, ready to fix your tickets whenever you fucked up. You have never paid the bill, never. And no one ever calls you on it, because you're so completely fucking special.
Everyone was always so proud of you.
And me too. Me the worst.
She pushed him back, deeper into the chair, his knees jutting out. She leaned forward, resting her arms on top of his knees, resting her head on top of her arms. She perched at the edge of his lap, staring up at him, torturing him.
It just makes it a whole lot easier for me, she sighed.
I mean, it's totally depressing. What have I been doing this for my whole pathetic fucking life? She seemed to wait for him to say something.
Well, she said softly, a situation like this does clear the sinuses now, doesn't it?
And Stanton finally looked up, looked at her, pleading silently, but Libby wasn't buying.
So here's the deal, she said. You move on Picker, I move on you.
You wouldn't, said Susan, whose eyes were red.
Try me, Libby said, turning toward her, breaking off her pursuit of Jack Stanton.
You would end his political career? Susan asked.
I bust dust, Libby said,
getting to her feet now, moving toward her satchel, getting ready to leave.
My job is to prevent people from hurting you, including you.
To my mind, you would hurt yourselves grievously if you acted to destroy Freddie Picker, who, I think we all agree, is a flawed but decent man. She hesitated, wiping her eyes once, then again, but the tears were flowing now.
And so, yes, Libby concluded, I will destroy this village in order to save it.
And she dashed out of that room faster than it seemed possible for a big woman to move. I raced after her. People were gathering outside now for the last meeting of the Stanton campaign. Brad Lieberman, Duane Forrest, Lorene, Leon, Howard, and Lucille. Libby pushed past them, teary, hair flying through the smoke from Fat Willie's barbecue toward her Jeep Cherokee.
You drive, she said, tossing the keys over her shoulder toward me, never having to look back, knowing I'd be there.
She rode shotgun, sobbing quietly, tears streaming. Drive yourself home. I did. I parked next to the river.
So, how'd I do?
She smiled thinly through the tears. Just fine, I said. More controlled than with Randy Culligan. More nuanced.
But the gun was just as big, she smiled and sniffled. Henry, you are out of here, right?
Not much left to stay here for, is there?
Look up there, she said.
A pale full moon had appeared in the still light sky.
That's me, she said.
Beautiful, huh?
Very impressive to the earthlings.
But Henry, honey, it's only reflected light. It needs the sun. And I lived my life drawing light and warmth from the Stantons, and God, they were so good and glowing. I could go for years without remembering I wasn't producing any warmth myself, any light of my own. But the day does come when you look in the mirror, and all you see is a dead rock. You know what I'm saying, right?
Ooh-ha, I said,
a sorry third-rate attempt at a Libby impersonation.
You a dead rock? You a lackey? Ooh fucking ha! I'm a lackey. You're the French Foreign Legion.
Well, idiot boy, she said, shaking her head. How the fuck do you think I earned placement in that booby hatch? It wasn't an up thing, you know. It was a down thing. You know what I'm saying, right? I look in the mirror and see the dead rock. Without them, I'm dark and black and cold and dead and empty and airless for eternity. And they don't fucking need me at all. All they need is to glow. Drove me nuts. I was so bummed, so deep, deep down. I got trapped in the bathroom, on the floor just below the mirror where I saw the moon rock. I couldn't get up off the floor. For several days, apparently. Susan found me. She put me, can you imagine, into an asylum for lunatics. Moon people, what a hoot. All these unplugged folks and me with a busted solar heater. So I figured it must be okay now. You are now an official lunatic. Go for it. Turns out, though, the act, howling at the moon, has a limited shelf life.
It's also kind of shizzy if you're a moon rock yourself. You got the best part of the show, Henri. But it's over. I quit. There was nothing I could say to that. I put a hand on her shoulder. There was an awkward gesture. Henri, she said, not looking at me, but staring straight ahead, mesmerized by the dashboard. I can't bear the thought of going deep, deep down again. You look straight up, and there's a tiny point of light way up there. And that's where the world is. And you don't have the energy to start moving toward the light. You don't even have the energy to assimilate Brahms or chew your food. I don't ever want to be there again. I just won't risk that. She stopped, shook her head. They didn't even fucking hesitate just now. You saw that. Not a lick of humanity. Not a thought about Freddy Picker. Fucking glowworms! She put out her hand for the keys. I gave them to her. What an idiot I was. See? She said, weeping again, streaks down both sides of her face. The deal is, Henri, don't let it happen to you. You still have something of an atmosphere. Don't worry about light. Think about oxygen depletion. Find yourself a life, okay? She leaned over and kissed my cheek, and I threw my arms around her, and we stayed there for a while, both of us snuffling and hanging on for dear life. Finally, she pulled away and put her big hands on my shoulders. Now, get gone. Go find Daisy. And what about you? I asked, opening the door, moving out. She slid into the driver's seat. When you're in limbo, she said, pulling away, there are only two ways you can go. Bye, sweetie.